Today, once again, we're doing two different activities. And just like last time, they don't take the same amount of time. One takes a lot longer than the other. The one that doesn't take much time, and probably most of you will do it last, but it doesn't really matter, is the testing pH of different solutions. There's two identical trays. You can use either one. It's just a matter of using the test strips. It's pretty self-explanatory. Tell me if you have any problems with that, but it's pretty straightforward. The other one's also pretty straightforward, which is conducting tests for the presence of certain chemicals in solution. And I'm specifically talking about the protocol that starts on page 47. There are three different tests we're going to perform today. Anyone know what those are without looking? Exactly. The Biuret test, the Benedict's test, and the IKI test. Now, I'm only really going to talk about one of these because the other two, it's a matter of just following instructions. Well, I'll just mention what they test for, which is also listed, but you should know this already. Biuret test is a test for the presence of what?
Proteins,
yes. The IKI test gets its name, by the way, because IKI is a chemical formula. It's iodine potassium iodide. That's the stuff that's in the test solution. But it tests for the presence of what? No?
Starch.
What is starch, by the way, chemically speaking? It's a polysaccharide, exactly. Stuff we'll be talking about in detail in the next lecture when we start the survey of the macromolecules. So those two are pretty straightforward. Just go ahead and follow instructions. Let me know if you have problems, but work it out with each other. Talk it out as usual. The only one I really want to talk about a little bit is the Benedict's test, which tests for the presence of monosaccharides. That's not a specific chemical. That's a category of chemicals. Monosaccharides are simple sugars that can be hooked together to make polysaccharides, but they are molecules in their own right if they are not connected to anything else. They're just a simple sugar, a one subunit sugar. And I want to explain how Benedict's solution, the blue stuff you'll be working with to test for presence of monosaccharides, how it works chemically. And doing that requires explaining something that is confusing at first, but also important not only in here, but even more so eventually upstairs when we'll get to this topic in great detail, especially in Unit 3. And what I'm talking about are redox reactions. Now, redox is a portmanteau, which is a word that's two words combined into one. Redox is short for reduction oxidation. Reduction slash oxidation. And it's not just easier to say redox than it is to say reduction and oxidation, but it's kind of good that they use one word to describe both of these, because you can't have one of these happening without the other also happening. They always go hand in hand. In other words, in any given redox reaction, something gets reduced, something undergoes reduction, in other words, and something else gets oxidized or undergoes oxidation. So you can't have one without the other. The confusing part at first, when you're first learning this, maybe you've already learned it in other courses, but at first it's confusing terminology, because in everyday use of the word reduce, you're used to meaning something is lost. Like reducing weight, for instance. You lose mass, you have less weight. But chemically speaking, reduction is the gain of an electron. And oxidation is just the opposite. Oxidation is loss of an electron. Now, the way you can make sense of this and why the linguistics actually is not really backwards is to remember what an electron is. It's a negatively charged particle, right? So if you receive an electron, your charge is becoming more negative. It's being numerically reduced, in other words, by gaining the electron. So make sense of it that way. If you lose the electron, numerically, the charge is going up, but we call that oxidation. Okay? We'll have much more to say about oxidation reduction in the lecture eventually, but this is the introduction to it as far as this course is concerned. Now, if that's not already confusing, there's even more confusion that can result, terminology-wise. And that's because whatever the thing is that is becoming reduced in a redox reaction, in other words, the thing that is receiving the electron, it is being reduced, right, by definition of reduction. But we call that thing the oxidizing agent because by becoming reduced, by receiving the electron, something else is becoming oxidized because something has to give that electron up. So the thing that oxidizes something else is the oxidizing agent. It becomes reduced, though, in the process. The oxidizing agent is the thing that becomes reduced, but it's called the oxidizing agent because it causes something else to be oxidized. And conversely, the thing that is becoming oxidized by losing its electron is called the reducing agent because by losing that electron, something else takes it on and becomes reduced. Everyone have that straight? Okay, now back to monosaccharides, which is the thing that we are looking for the presence of in the Benedict's test. You know, you have a solution that it's either totally unknown what's in it, or maybe you know that there is some kind of sugar in there, you just don't know what kind. You can use Benedict's reagent to tell whether or not there are monosaccharides, simple sugars. And monosaccharides as a group, which there's many examples of, glucose, for instance, is a monosaccharide, fructose is a monosaccharide, and so on. But monosaccharides in general, whichever specific one it is, are classified, or they're called reducing sugars. Because they can be reducing agents in a redox reaction. Now, based on what I just told you the definition of a reducing agent is, that means the sugar, the monosaccharide, is becoming what?
Oxidized.
Right. In other words, it's losing an electron. They're called reducing sugars because they cause something else to be reduced when the sugar itself becomes oxidized. Now to the component of Benedict's solution, the blue stuff back there, that allows for this to happen. Benedict's solution is mostly water, but it's a solution, so it's not just pure water. It's a solution of copper ions. Okay? Now what is the chemical symbol for copper? Cu. And it's right here on the periodic table. Remember that the metals are everything below this, right? So most of the things are metals. Well, these first ones are alkali metals. These are alkaline earth metals. You don't have to know those names. But then you get this big block right here between all of this stuff right here. Those are called transition metals. And the reason they're different from these first two groups is that everything in group one, if it forms an ion, is going to do it just one way, by losing exactly one electron to become a positive one ion, just like sodium, the example used in class. Everyone in group two loses two electrons to become a positive two ion. But the metals that are in the transition block here, some of them can do it either of multiple ways. So that those metals don't necessarily make only one kind of ion. And copper is an example of a transition metal that can make two different kinds of ions. All right? And those two different versions are copper 1, which we write as Cu with a 1 plus superscript, and copper 2, which is Cu with a 2 plus superscript. Now, compared to a copper atom, how is a copper 2 ion formed? By losing two electrons. And a copper 1 ion by losing one electron. Okay, so there's two different copper ions. Well, if you look at page 48, you can see that what makes the Benedict solution blue is that it's chock full of copper 2 ions. That's the solute, copper 2 ions, in Benedict's solution. And that's what makes it, to us, look blue. Okay? Now, these tests in general, not just Benedict's test, but all three that you're investigating, they work as tests because the presence of whatever they're looking for causes some visible change. In the case of Benedict's solution, it's a color change from blue, which it is originally, to some other color. But if you have copper 2 ions only, then those copper 2 ions make the solution blue. Now, there are trillions and trillions of overall copper ions, even in a little bit of volume of solution. If there are monosaccharides in there, if you add monosaccharides to that reagent or Benedict solution, then some of those copper ions can be changed to copper 1 ions. All right? Now, if a copper 2 ion becomes a copper 1 ion, what is happening to the copper 2 ion chemically? Well, you're half right. It is gaining an electron, but that's not oxidation. Remember that the gaining of an electron is reduction. That's what seems backwards in language. Gaining an electron is reduction because that will numerically reduce the overall charge. Well, what is the overall charge of copper 2? Positive 2 before anything happens, right? If it gains an electron, it now doesn't have as many. I mean, it now has an additional negative to counteract the positives, and therefore the overall charge is only positive 1. That's a numerical reduction from 2 to 1, which is what reduction is, the gain of an electron. Well, that's not going to happen, of course, unless something gives up an electron. And this is why it can test for monosaccharides, because a sugar in monosaccharide form is able to give up an electron, specifically from the double bond between a carbon and an oxygen in the sugar, as you see on page 48. Now, what do we call that functional group that is a carbon double bonded to an oxygen? A carbonyl group, exactly. Every monosaccharide in linear form, as we'll see later, monosaccharides can be either in linear or ringed form. But if they are in the linear form, as that structural formula shown there for glucose is, and that's what you built with the models, with the linear form of glucose, Any monosaccharide, though, not just glucose, that is in the linear form has a carbonyl group in it somewhere. And carbonyl groups can easily give up an electron that is being shared in that double bond. And what takes that electron is copper 2, transforming it into, or reducing it into copper 1, and that makes it look red to us. Well, it will if effectively all of those copper 2 ions get reduced into copper 1. If you have a solution of nothing but copper 1 ions, it will be brick red, not blue at all. All right? And that will happen if you have a lot of monosaccharides. If you don't have any monosaccharides, then none of the copper 2s get reduced and it stays blue. But if you have some monosaccharides, just not enough to reduce all of the copper 2s, then your solution will be a combination of copper 2 and copper 1 ions, and it'll be some intermediate color between blue and brick red. So it goes green and yellow, you get all kinds of different colors. Which means that not only is this a yes-no result, meaning either yes, there are monosaccharides, or no, there aren't, but it also allows you to qualitatively, not quantitatively, not in numbers, but qualitatively know how much is there compared to other solutions. In other words, if it goes all the way to brick red, you know there's a lot compared to one that would change it to yellow. That's what I mean by a qualitative result. You don't really know the molarity of it. You're not measuring the actual concentration, but you can tell compared to other solutions which has more and which has less monosaccharide. Any questions on all of that? Okay, well, for all three of these tests, you need to do some preliminary work. Your goal, eventually, is to try to figure out the contents of whichever unknown solutions you eventually choose, but you can't skip right to this. You need to do some preliminary work because you need to know, you need to experience a true negative and a true positive for each of these tests so that you know what they look like when they happen. So the preliminary result consists of you choosing from these solutions in your white basket, choose appropriately for each test. For instance, Benedict's tests for monosaccharides, right? For a true negative, you want to use something that you know doesn't have any monosaccharides in it. And you add it, and it, whatever color it is, it should remain blue, but look at it and see how blue it is for a true negative. And then pick something that you know has monosaccharides in it to get a true positive. Okay? Do that for each of the three tests, but choose different solutions appropriately to get negative and positive. That's the background work. Then you can go on to choose three unknowns. But you need to do this a specific way. Notice that there are four A's, four B's, and four C's. Write down which one you have, because A1 and A2, A3, and A4, they're all different. But each group needs to choose one of the A's, it doesn't matter which one, just write down which one you have, one of the B's and one of the C's. And each of these three, you need to test with all three tests. So you'll be, once you do your preliminary tests, then you'll be doing 9 tests on the unknown, right? 3A tests, 3B tests, 3C tests. In other words, you test A for monosaccharide, you test it for protein, and you test it separately, of course, for starch, using all three tests. Based on the results of those 9 tests, you then try to figure out the contents of that particular unknown, and the manual tells you what the possibilities are. Okay, so it's a deductive reasoning exercise after you get your actual results. Make your guesses, well, not truly guesses, make your deductions, and then tell me what you think they are, tell me what your solutions were, and I can check what the answers are, and we'll see if you were able to do it correctly. Now, you're not going to be graded on whether you get them correct, of course. Your grading is done for the day. You already did your quiz. But that's the essence of it. Okay? In that case, the only other thing I wanted to say is that the repipe header confuses some people. For the other test, you don't have this, but for Benedict's solution, you use this repipe header, which is just a kind of pump, but unlike a shampoo pump that you're just used to pushing down at the top, that's not how this works. So with an empty test tube first, put it under the spout. Don't touch this lock, this blue lock, because it's set for 2 milliliters right now. Don't mess with that. But just grab it on the sides of the white tube. Pull it gently all the way until it stops up. Pull it upward. And then just gently push it down until it stops, and that will deliver 2 milliliters into your tube. You don't have to... No graduated cylinder used today. You're just using the repipe header and some drops from your solutions. This is all, by the way, safe to put down the sink as well. So when you're done, you know, you're not scrubbing these test tubes, but you can give them just one quick rinse and then put them in the dirty test tube bin. That is it. Oh, while I still have your attention, though, since we did a test, I'll be handing back your Scantrons, and I'll put the test up. I'll tape it up on the wall. Now, what did you promise me when you filled out the rules consent form? Or did you skip right to the bottom and hit submit? You agreed that you would immediately fail the course if you recorded the questions in any way. So get yourself, don't have your cell phones out there. You can't photograph it. You can't rewrite the questions in your notes. You can talk to me about it, of course, but you can't record the questions. All right? So don't accidentally do it. That's it.